From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. First-time novelist Eileen Curtwright is no stranger to the challenges of modern parenting, but she lays them out wild and wonderful in her very funny new novel, The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska, the story of a single mom at work in a fertility clinic struggling to keep it together for her son and herself, her love life, her dreams, with the whole town watching. It's kind of scary, and in Curtwright's hands, hilarious. This hour on Point, The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska, and the real challenges of modern parenting. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you living your version of this? Have you felt how impossible, how wacky it can all get sometimes? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look at the evolving role of mothers on TV lately. But first, joining me from San Antonio, Texas, is Eileen Curtwright. Her debut novel is The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Washington Post describes it as hookups, hijinks, and hilarity in hometown USA, as refreshing as it is occasionally insane. That's a mixture I really enjoyed. Eileen Curtwright, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You, madam, can really deliver sort of line-by-line laughs here. I don't laugh out loud that often lately at a book I'm in the midst of, and yours had me right there. There's a place in here where Rebecca Meir, Becky Meir, you're pretty out there and wonderful protagonist here. Is talking with the doctor about potentially some meds for her son, but no, not really. What she wants is ADHD stuff, or maybe some Ritalin, maybe something for herself. What has driven her to that point in your story, Eileen?
Well, I think it's the humanly impossible standards that mothers are held to and hold themselves to in our kind of contemporary parenting climate. It starts early on. From the moment you become pregnant, you start worrying about every little aspect of your motherhood and your relationship with your child. And if you don't step back and start to, have second thoughts about how true some of these ideas are, you can really drive yourself nuts.
Where's the perfection demand? Perfect in what regard? Or every regard? Where? What?
Well, I mean, I think that, you can never be too good of a mother is sort of the idea that we struggle with. And how do you know that you're being good enough? I mean, just personally, when I was expecting my first child, I remember reading so many books like so many expectant women do. And they said things like, your negative emotions and stress can have an adverse effect on the fetus's development. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to mess up my kid before it even sees daylight. I mean, the stakes just couldn't be higher at every moment of parenting, from the earliest, conception through, I guess, when they go off to college at an elite university with a full scholarship,
right,
which seems to be everyone's goal.
Right. The single mom that you put at the center of this in Little Ward, Nebraska, is anything but human perfection here. She's lovingly portrayed, but at the same time, she's out there in about a million directions. She works in this fertility clinic. How old is her? Mitchell is...
He's
10. That's what I thought. 10 years old, mm-hmm, in this book, and everybody understands him to be a product of carefully selected sperm from the fertility clinic, ergo single mom. She runs into an old boyfriend who's gone off to California, I guess, and made a mint in high tech and all that. He's back in town unexpectedly, Kevin. And you've got her thinking to herself, my reputation locally was uptight workaholic, but Kevin held a contrary opinion. He considered me to be a raving lunatic and not, I considered, conceited without some justification. Introduce us to Becky Meir, working there in the fertility clinic. But how can she be in the same little town seen as uptight workaholic and raving lunatic?
Well, I guess every mother has a past, and before she took on the role of mom and serious professional woman, she was a different person. And the drama of Rebecca Meir is that underneath it, or maybe not so much underneath at all as the novel progresses, she's still that same person who made crazy decisions, who behaved impulsively, and being a mother and a professional hasn't really changed who she is in her heart.
I wish you'd read a little bit for us from page, 62, I think this is, where she's on the playground. We'll look at some of the imperfections. But here is the realm where families, mothers, parents are competing for perfection or striving or thinking about it anyway for their kids. And she's out in the playground with another mother. And, of course, the conversation goes to pharmaceutical stimulants. Could you read for us, Eileen?
Sure. Okay. Look at our sons. Two of the boys were swinging at each other with huge inflatable boxing gloves, while Mitchell was running headfirst into the wall of the boxing ring, falling down and repeating the process. And then, look at Truett. Truett was sitting quietly on the carpet, which was decorated with images of our solar system. He was studying the tail of a comet with rapt attention. A string of shimmering drool hung from his lower lip. He's the perfect child, Laurel sighed. Anyway, we need you to find out what they're giving him so we can replicate it. You'd want to do that to your sons, I said. Absolutely, Madge said. We need to do it before they fall further behind Truett. Let me ask you this, Rebecca. What are Mitchell's grades like? Laurel said. They're okay, I lied. It was only half a lie. Some of them were okay. Do you think those grades reflect his full, innate potential? Laurel said. No. That's all we want for our kids, that they do the very best they can. But they can't do their best without pharmaceutical stimulants, I said. Exactly, Laurel said.
I love it. Eileen Curtwright, reading from her new book, first one, debut novel, The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. And there's almost a little note of Marge Simpson in that pharmaceutical stimulants. Exactly. I mean, you're a mom with three kids. You know how it is. Is it? You talk about an anxiety arms race. Is it really wound up that tight?
I think it can be at times. You know, you get together with other parents and they have kids who seem to be functioning well. Nothing really big to worry about. And yet the parents are so consumed with anxiety about their kids' performance in school and their futures. And so I think there's sort of a group hysteria that almost takes place where you think if these parents are at that level of anxious about their child, I've got to bring my anxiety level up at least that high or my kid will be left behind. I maybe am not doing everything I should be.
Listeners, do you see this anxiety arms race going on in your life, in your parenting circle? We're at 800-423-8255 with Eileen Curtwright, author of the new The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. At the same time, here she is, and she's at that point in life where she's trying to hang on to a lot of her youthful dreams that are under tremendous pressure here. And not just dreams, but also just impulses, and they're not all very sensible. I mean, you've got her with dreams, you've got her with sexual urges that she's following off in all kinds of places, and trying to be a parent at the same time. There is that sort of chapter of parenthood where there's a lot on the table at the same time, all the responsibilities of looking forward to the next generation, and still lots of dreams and impulses in the young parent themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as your child grows up, you're aging and growing too. And so you're not necessarily the same person when your child is 10 who you were when your child was born. And even I think that my character Rebecca has tried to totally devote herself to motherhood at the expense of any kind of personal life. And because maybe she hasn't well integrated those aspects of her identity, things start to come apart at the seams as she realizes she needs to be a human being and a mother.
So what's the message from Eileen Curtwright about trying to have it all or grub out whatever remnants of it all a person can grab?
Well, I just think that, you know, mothers particularly, we should be really skeptical of the idea that we have ultimate control over our children's destinies and that we have to shoot for perfection. We're all just sort of fumbling along, doing the best we can with hopefully love and good intentions. And there's not really a science to raising children. And you can't, you know, the experts are constantly changing. Whatever book all the mothers are reading about how to raise kids in Paris is, you know, the French have it all figured out. you know, in a few months it'll be something different. So it's kind of like the rules are always changing. If you pay too close attention to the latest fads, you're just going to, you know, drive yourself crazy.
Eileen Curtwright writes late in the book, has her Becky Mayer, the protagonist here, thinking, although sometimes I reflected that my son was the result of a series of impulsive, poor decisions, and that when they didn't destroy lives, careers, and civilizations, sometimes bad decisions were the best of all. Is that the flag you're flying here, Eileen? when life gets all unbuckled and all over the place, roll with it?
Yeah, I mean, what else can you do? We're not raising our children in a laboratory, so life is going to bring all kinds of unexpected things. We're all human beings who behave impulsively and irrationally at times. I mean, some of us more than others. Becky may be a little bit on the extreme side of that scale at certain moments of the book. But yeah, I think roll with it is really not bad advice.
You've got this great exchange where somebody else who's like, I guess, sleeping with her boss is just out of their yoga class and describing her as a bitter, lonely alcoholic with a weird kid having pity sex with the principal. But she's thinking the woman just out of the yoga class, Nina, I realized, was like a very toned and flexible Madame Bovary, and her perfectly balanced chakras couldn't sate her need for drama and chaos. Really, nobody's very perfectly balanced in this book. I guess that's the reality you're pointing to.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I have some satiric aims here. And to that end, I haven't crafted a bunch of perfectly heroic and admirable characters. I mean, I have a lot of affection for all of them, but they're all pretty flawed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with very funny first-time novelist Eileen Curtwright about her debut, The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska, and the crazy terrain sometimes of modern parenting, single parenting in particular. She joins us from San Antonio, Texas, where she's a mother of her own kids and very funny in conveying that of this little town. Kirkus Reviews calls it screamingly funny. Midwestern pragmatism meets lusty debauchery. You can join us this hour. Do you know this life chapter? Single moms, are you hearing yourself here? Dads, do you recognize the mayhem? And who gets judged? Who gets praised? Who gets the arched eyebrow these days when it comes to parenting? And is it harder now, crazier, or just in different ways? We've got callers for you. Eileen and Megan Leahy, parent coach, joins us in a moment. I wonder if you'd dive right in and read a little bit for us first, though. I think a lot of people will recognize this. She comes home from work to the babysitter with her child. This is Rebecca Becky Mir, and feels this deep pang of kind of guilt or jealousy of the babysitter, who people at school have said to her, oh, they thought the babysitter was the parent. Could you read some of that? She comes home and finds.
Sure. I heard the noise of high-velocity advertising as soon as I cracked my front door. And that's not all, the rapid-fire TV spokesman was saying. A terrarium with two frogs sat on the coffee table next to a tornado of school papers and a couple of banana peels. This should have made it easier to give Vicky the axe, except that I was late again. Now I lacked the moral authority to discontinue her services and would have to put it off until another day, when I was more firmly in the right. "Hey, guys," I said. Mitchell and Vicky were eating frozen personal pizzas on the couch, a practice I have explicitly banned. Neither of them looked up. They were transfixed by the ad for a revolutionary new kitchen tool that lets you prepare restaurant-style bloomin' onions at home with ease. Vicky was sprawled out in her roomy pants, dripping marinara on a Ward College Plainsman hoodie. Mitchell sat absolutely still with his usual rigid posture, too engrossed even to blink. I'd once imagined raising a polyglot, beret-wearing child who fed only on organic grapes, but I'd let go of that fantasy. Mitchell had turned out default American. He loved capitalism and footage of people gored by animals, and he preferred food that needed to be heated rather than cooked. I muted the volume on the TV, and the two of them jumped.
Default American, and the mom wishes she could fire the babysitter, but not today. There's always a reason, not today. Eileen Curtwright writing in here about tense playdates and uncomfortable school conferences and at a certain stage wiping spit up out of your hair six times a day. She joins us from San Antonio, Texas. A lot of callers for you, Eileen. Judy in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Judy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got to read this book, but I am a woman who was a single mother, married, divorced, and then a single mother again for the last several years of my kids living at home.
So you have to know what she's talking about.
I kind of do. And I think what worked for me is finding a way that I'm going to feel fulfilled in life rather than trying to struggle to be something I'm not or form my kids into something they're not. But what was really critical for me was communication, learning to communicate correctly, helping my kids learn to communicate, and letting them know that really no matter what, they could always come and talk to me and I cared about what they had to say. And now today with the 30 and 31-year-olds that I raised who are doing really well, I hear from them that that really made a difference. So
just talk to them. And but you know that moment of mayhem, those years maybe of a little bit of mayhem. Judy, thank you for your call. Let me get one more and I'll take it to Eileen. Cecilia in Buffalo, New York. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I definitely could associate with the first story that was told because I've moved from Silicon Valley to Buffalo, New York. I have a 20-year-old all the way down to a 5-year-old, so I'm having to do kindergarten all over again.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh, okay.
And it's and it really surprised me that it was the same. It's gotten worse, the competition, the performance anxiety for children. And what I learned is that we really do pass it on to them. My older son, because of the atmosphere of Silicon Valley, my 16-year-old was freaking out that he was going to just be making French fries for the rest of his life because he didn't see himself getting into Harvard and taking AP classes
with a
4.6 average. And I'm rethinking it with my 5-year-old because, you know what, you can hedge your bets, but they're not going to be the same people 15 years from now, and they really are separate human beings than us. So the projection really has to stop at some point. So thank you very much.
It takes a long time
to
get that wisdom, hard-earned. Cecilia, thank you. I mean, Eileen, James is writing here also on that, you know, we're going to make French fries for the rest of our lives if we don't get in. James says, why do we all obsess over an elite university? Isn't the goal here to create happy, healthy, independent children? And yet that obsession about where we end up, why is that now? Is that because the economy has become tougher?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a mysterious phenomenon, I think. I think there must be a lot of reasons. The economy and maybe just society is becoming more status-obsessed in general. But, you know, I really agree with those two moms who called in. I have never distinguished myself academically in sports. I was a completely average kid, and yet I lead a pretty happy life, and people still like me, and I just, some people anyway, and I just think that we need to dial down our expectations. You don't have, the alternatives are not Harvard or utter failure. There's a huge middle ground.
And a lot of room to let people be what they will be. You can't always just project, as Cecilia is saying there. Elizabeth in New Orleans, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
So I'm here in New Orleans, and, you know, I remember Violet being a brand new baby. She's 4 now. And thinking to myself, how do these mothers get their kids dressed to the nines? I just want my baby to wear a onesie every single day of her life. Like, it's totally unbelievable what mothers do. And I don't think that we get the credit that we deserve. I think that, you know, this book is a beautiful example of how we're all different. We're all doing our best. And how that mass hysteria is totally real. I mean, there's only really a few good schools. I mean, even decent schools to go to here in New Orleans. And everybody is trying to get their kid in there. And just talking to parents can be unbelievably frustrating. I usually avoid it, to be perfectly honest with you, just so that I don't feel this kind of unreal pressure to get my kid to be something that, you know, frankly, she wants to be an artist.
Elizabeth, do you feel judged, Elizabeth, when you bring your kids in their onesie that they've worn all week long?
Sure, all the time. I mean, I'm an artist myself, and the fact of the matter is sometimes we're late for school that begins at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the teachers all look at me and the parents all look at me, and it's like, look, just because my life isn't like yours, doesn't mean that I'm wrong or that I'm in the wrong, or just because I forgot to bring a second pair of underwear for my dog because she has an accident, it doesn't make me a criminal. You know what I'm saying? But it's hard to keep your head up day after day.
Yeah.
So many people judging you, and they do. They do expect perfection.
Elizabeth, no criminal. We hear that loud and clear. Eileen, give us a sense in your fictional telling of this of how the judging goes on.
Well, I think it's especially because my character is a single mother, there's almost a presumption against her in her small town that she's going to screw this up. And so the judging goes on when her son doesn't, he's not a bad kid, but he's not an academic high achiever. He's not always well behaved. And so the school thinks it's a problem. The principal wants him medicated, and Rebecca says, no, he's, you know, the problem is he's 10 years old. He's a child. That's really the only problem, is she thinks that people have lost sight of what childhood means.
Eileen Cartwright's new book, and it is very funny, let me tell you, sort of line by line, it really, really tickled me. But it's the tickle of reality and kind of crazy reality sometimes. It's The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. She's with us today from San Antonio. You grew up in Nebraska, right, Eileen?
No, actually, mostly in San Antonio.
San Antonio. Okay. Forgive me. I thought you had time in Nebraska there. Why did you choose Nebraska as the setting then?
Well, I've always maintained connections to Nebraska.
Okay.
I have lived there as an adult, and my husband is from Nebraska. I have family there still. So
just a safe distance from San Antonio, maybe.
Well, and it's the heartland, you know? Yeah. So I feel like a satire that takes place in middle America, it's sort of quintessential America to me.
It is very funny. Eileen Cartwright, stand by there in San Antonio. With us from Washington right now is Megan Leahy. She's a parenting columnist at the Washington Post and a certified parent coach, mother of three daughters herself. Megan Leahy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
Okay, first of all, I didn't know there was such a thing as a certified parent coach. What is that, Megan?
It's so weird, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
It's like an already odd branch off the already dubious tree of coaching. And I love coaches. I use them all the time. But as a parent coach, I only talk to parents about their children, which means a regular coach might talk to you about pivoting in your career and your life. So I only talk
to parents. I call you at midnight when it's just not going right, and you start the clock running and give me advice on how to make my family life work out?
It actually would go to voicemail, but
but I need help now.
Pretty much. People call me who are in crisis. And I don't super nanny situations. I don't go into homes. I only talk to the parents and help them walk through the issues in their home.
And what kind of questions do you get? I think you've read The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. Do you get material that sounds like out of this sort of zany environment that Aline has brought us?
So I haven't finished it, but I laughed out loud when they went into the principal's office, and he immediately goes, oppositional defiance disorder, ADHD, right?
Everybody gets diagnosed. Kids aren't just kids. Oh, they're all diagnosed with some kind of syndrome.
And I laughed, but I also was so profoundly sad because this is why people call me, right? So people call me because their four-year-old cannot sit in circle at school, and they're becoming a discipline problem.
Yeah.
Right. And so I am called because this is a problem. And so what I end up navigating is that, no, the culture is the problem.
And the culture is what? How would you describe that problematic culture that poor Becky Mears in Eileen's book is in the midst of?
Well, Eileen hit it on the head when they said, we need to medicate your child. And she said, no, the problem isn't his brain. The problem is his maturity, that he's 10. Mm-hmm. So the problem with our culture, largely, not always, is not the child. It is our developmentally incorrect assumptions about what children can and cannot do.
And everything has to be perfect. So if they're not mature at 10, which why would they be, bring out the diagnosis.
Absolutely. And diagnoses, I'm not going to throw them 100% under the bus. They can be life-saving for some children. But let's face it, it's all a money game. It's about insurance. It's about coding.
Oh, geez.
But meanwhile, that is a human. That goes in a file. An oppositional defiance disorder is serious. And so when we throw around these terms in a cavalier way, those have lasting ramifications for children, well, even beyond medication, which a lot of the medications, again, are life-saving for some children, but they are adult medications just made weaker for a lot of children in a lot of cases, and largely not necessary.
So many callers here. I've got to turn to them. Leah in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Leah, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to touch on something Eileen said earlier in the interview about the experience of the mom in a small town or a smaller town where she's got a close relationship with other moms and feels the need to kind of compete with their stress level in order to define success as a mom.
Yeah.
And I kind of have an interesting relation to that. I started off as a mom at 16. I'm now pushing 40. And my oldest is 22. My youngest is 10, three kids. And as I grew as a mom and had different experiences at very different ages as a mom, I saw that when, as a young mom, my circle of experience was more defined, you know, kind of restricted to my town, I had only those experiences and those relationships to reference and compare myself to. And I discovered that later in life, as I had more experiences and just much more observance of actual life, that it made me redefine success both as a parent and for my child as well. And it became less and less about academic and sort of financial success in that part of life.
Yeah.
And I've redefined them as with the good people that I want them to become are going to be civic-minded and responsible and accountable. So now I look for opportunities, not just in academia, but for my kids to be exposed to those things and to develop that within themselves.
Leah, it's great, and you've gotten wise over time, and I appreciate your call. But Eileen, part of what you're pointing at here is that we're not necessarily wise at the time all this is unfolded. I mean, even now when people tend to have kids later, there's so much going on when you're in the thick of this that it's not like you're sitting on a mountain becoming a Zen master. It's all happening in a kind of tumult very often.
Yeah, the wisdom is hard won, and it happens amid chaos. And so, yeah, I think that's why every day can feel like a minor disaster as a parent. You're just sort of fumbling through, and there isn't a lot of time for reflection when you're in the thick of it. I think over time you can look back, like the caller said, and realize that you have matured as much or more than your child in some cases. But day to day, it's really just kind of putting out fires a lot of the time.
And the competition can go so far upstream. Early in the book, you write that her son, your protagonist, Becky's son, 10, he was fully comfortable with his origin story. He'd been created in my lab. She works in a fertility clinic, remember, under sterile conditions with the best sperm money can buy. But her sister Madge, you write, resented it as a form of cheating. Her boys were conceived naturally and don't come close to Mitchell's IQ. I mean, that idea that you might compete all the way up the stream of life to the very origin, to the very conception.
Yeah, it's crazy. But you just, I don't know how much that kind of thing really happens, but you do read about couples, you know, selecting for certain traits. They want a green-eyed boy or something like that. And you just wonder if technology advances and these things become affordable, is everyone going to want some kind of super baby instead of, you know, the luck of the draw that we usually settle for these days?
Things get more complicated in the book. But Megan, I thought it was kind of genius to set the woman here in a fertility clinic where people come in with their frustrations and problems, but also their dreams.
Yeah. Yeah. And the dreams, I think we all have dreams for our families even before we start to have them. And reality smacks us in the face in some kind of way. But it's an interesting way to begin for sure in the book. I loved it.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with very funny first-time novelist Eileen Curtwright about her debut, The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska, and the crazy terrain of modern parenting. Single parenting in particular, she's calling out here. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us from San Antonio, Texas, and certified parent coach Megan Leahy is with us as well from Washington, parenting columnist at the Washington Post. She gets the calls. She answers the calls when people just don't know what to do next. We're going to talk in a moment about moms on TV. Ben writes us on Twitter, says, I don't think mothers get the credit they deserve. Ben says, agreed, but let's not lose dads in the mix. We are here too. Amen to that, Ben, and we know it. But today, Eileen is all over The Single Mom, the Becky Mears of her book, and it's very funny. Just trying to hang on, get through, make a life, raise the child. Fran in Yukon, Oklahoma. Fran, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a 66-year-old grandmother with grandchildren from almost 13 to 19 months.
Okay.
And I had my kids when I was in my 20s, and the last one at 31, but primarily my 20s. And I was so in the moment and rushing through parenting that I don't think I had time to overthink things.
Mm-hmm.
But I see with my daughters who have theirs in their 30s, two of them are actually in vitro babies, so I can identify with the fertility clinic
yes.
part.
Mm-hmm.
They are so, you know, they're at the point in their careers where they're worrying about careers and their future, and they're coming to terms with the fact that they're never going to be Mark Zuckerberg, and they're also throwing babies into the mix.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. But no wonder they're all so angst-filled and, oh, my God, am I doing this right? It's almost like on some levels they no longer have the time to enjoy having kids and being a mom.
Friend, you've got the long view and a little wisdom to go with it there. Let me take that to Megan first. Is age the issue if you're having kids sort of more in your 30s than your 20s? Maybe in 20s it's just a hubbub and you just do it. But by your 30s you're judging the world and yourself more harshly. Do you find that, Megan?
You know, you'll find the data to support anything you want to believe. Have the kids younger, you have more energy. Have the kids older, you have more wisdom. Have your kid in your 30s, you blow up your life. It's really person to person. It really, really is. Trends don't want to believe that. But as soon as you start a family and we mash all these movements we have going together, we're at the not tail end, but we are reaping the benefits of women in the workplace. And we're also coming to grips with what that means in terms of raising children. And we're getting it right and we're getting it wrong. And our culture is getting it wrong. Our policies are getting it wrong. Family leave is getting it wrong. Expectations. So I never will tie anything to age because it's just the cheap way out.
There's this hilarious moment where the school is not hitting the testing targets, and everybody's worried there's going to be mass layoffs. And yes, she's having that pity sex with the principal, and on and on. And you're right. She asks herself, "What would I do? I'd vote for the school bond in the last election." She says it had gone down in defeat due to a tsunami of anti-tax sentiment from our town's retirees. Not our caller, Fran from Yukon, Oklahoma, maybe, but who were satisfied that the rising generation already had enough education to empty their bedpans. Never mind the high expectations. Just have that. Allison in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Allison, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is something that really resonates with me. I feel like we were on such a fast track with our kids, and I really wanted to opt out, but my older daughter, who ended up going to Yale, was very driven in her high school years. And, you know, one AP, two AP, not enough. You have to take all APs. You have to row crew. You have to do theater. You have to do it all. And I feel like our family was robbed of time with her in the last couple years of her high school.
Wait, you won the race. You won the game as it's been laid out here, but you feel like you were robbed.
So this is what's interesting to me. My second child is a completely different kid, and we looked at different kinds of schools for her, looking for a much more small school experience. And on the way, I discovered so many little gems of schools who I believe are getting it right, that they are focused on the students, that the professors are there for the students. At Yale, there were professors who stood up and said, I'd rather be doing research, read the textbook. You know, that's what it's there for. And I just think that's a shame. I mean, of course,
Allison, our time is short, but let us take it right there. It's so fascinating. I mean, Eileen, by any measure, that's supposed to be the win, and yet Allison feels robbed. I mean, you've said, Eileen, to cut right down to the heart of it, that the most challenging thing about parenthood is that for all the sort of pseudoscience, parenthood is just a relationship between two flawed human beings. And you can't mold a child into some kind of perfection, and in some ways should not try.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you can want your child to be CEO of an energy company, but unless your kid wants that, it's never going to happen. And I think the caller is so right that kids are different, and you have to sort of support each one on their own personal journey. But high achievement does come at a cost, sometimes to family life. I think that's really true.
Megan, you got a good laugh here in Burned Bridges?
It really captures so many things that so many parents are up against, and the characters are hilarious. I was really laughing really hard.
Eileen, you've got a knack for this. Are you going to stick with this? I hope you'll do more. This really is funny and so beautifully closely observed. You got another one on the drawing boards, or is it all kids now?
Oh, no, I sure do. I hope to stick with both mothering and writing for many years to come. So,
mothering and writing. Eileen Kurtwright's debut novel is The Burned Bridges of Ward, Nebraska. You can find an excerpt on our website at onpointradio.org. She's a mother of three daughters herself, joining us today from San Antonio, Texas. Eileen Kurtwright, thank you very much for being with us. Terrific to have you. It was really a fun read. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Megan Leahy, parenting columnist at the Washington Post, certified parent coach. Does the phone really ring? Are people looking for it, Megan? They're calling you? The business is hopping?
Every day.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yep.
But given everything we've heard here, we understand it. Mother of three, parenting coach, Megan Leahy. Thank you very much for your time today, Megan.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, we will look at the growing, changing, evolving role of television moms. This is On Point. Moms have always been around on TV. Carol Brady, June Cleaver, Roseanne Barr. But they haven't always been so front and center and so diverse in their age, their role in the family, how they raise their kids, and their relationships to them. The TV mom, says New York Times TV critic Neil Genslinger, is out front now and evolving. Neil Genslinger joins us now from Plainsboro, New Jersey. His recent piece is Mother, Television's Favorite Role. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Neil, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what is changing here?
In the long view, we have really gone from a time when there was only one mother on television, whatever the show was, and you know that mother. She's the mother in the apron in the kitchen.
Yeah.
That's all you saw. To what we have today, and especially in the last couple weeks, there's just been a nice pile up of really interesting episodes of various shows that had mothers doing all kinds of things. We have the mother, the television mother, might be the broadest character there is on TV right now. You can find any kind of mother you can imagine in some show on television. You can find the traditional, you know, cookie making mother. You can find the single mother, the working mother, the lesbian mother, anything you can imagine. The law breaking mother. And so that's what my piece was sort of. I was struck by, you know, this richness of various types of mothers that were piling up all of a sudden.
The range and the prominence in the dramas that they star in. And you write that the sort of mother of this new chapter of mothers may go back to Roseanne Barr. And Roseanne ran from 88 to 97 around the Connors family. Here's this little scene from the first season. 1988, Roseanne's kids are fighting over who gets to sit in a particular chair.
Mom, tell her to get out of my chair. Mom, tell her I was here first. Mom, tell her she's lying.
DJ, tell your sisters to shut up.
Shut up.
Okay, that's 1988. Play it forward. And one of those you write about, Neil, is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on CW right now. You say it's one of the fall's best new comedies. You've got the title character, Rebecca, that's Rachel Bloom, going head-to-head with her equally crazy mother, that's Tova Feldshuh here. What's at the heart of this one, Neil?
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend might be my favorite new show. It's this wacky take about a woman, I think she must be in her 30s, who is still fixated on a boy she met when in summer camp in high school. But for the first seven episodes, we kept hearing about her mother, and we'd hear her over the telephone and stuff like that, but we never saw her. But this week, Tova Feldshuh turns up, and the two of them had just some wonderful scenes, just full of bitterness and love and their very complex mother-daughter relationship, and it was wonderful to see.
It gets pretty nuts here. I got a little moment, Neil, where the mom, played by Tova, shows up. Rachel's gone out to follow her ex-boyfriend Josh to live on the West Coast, and mom shows up and comes to visit and enters in song.
Where's the bathroom? Where's the bathroom? I need to use the bathroom. Tell me that you have a bathroom in this hovel you call home. I don't know which was bumpier, the plane ride or the taxi. All these freeways are a nightmare. Where's my purse? I need my comb. By the way, you're looking healthy, and by healthy, I mean chunky. I don't mean that as an insult. I'm just stating it as fact.
They're from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So what's the mom profile there, presentation, Neil?
In that particular case, it's a mom bitterness, and you see the same sort of dynamic on another show I like, which is CBS's Mom. It's called Mom. There are three generations of mothers in that show. The oldest one, played by Allison Janney, who's one of the best actresses working today, and then there's her daughter and that daughter's daughter, and they had a wonderful episode last week, the Thanksgiving episode, where the three of them got together, and it was that was another wonderful bit of writing in very short scenes, you really could get the whole dynamic of what was going on with these three women, and I admire the writing on a lot of these shows.
Let's sample that one a little bit. From that last week's episode here from CBS's Mom.
I know I haven't been the best daughter lately.
Careful. Could be a trap.
I never call. I never check to see how you're doing.
Well, honey, in your defense, I think that's just because you don't like me.
And that's fine.
No, it's not.
I like it. So the evolution here, is there more power in these moms than when it was June Cleaver? Is there more honesty?
There's a little of both, or actually a lot of both. There's much more willingness to make these women into complex characters who, you know, they have likes, they have dislikes, they have sexual needs, they have aspirations. Whereas, you know, in the old days, the mom was basically about her kids, you know, and that's all she was really there for.
Who's writing these, Neil? We hear about writers' rooms full of men. Is that the case for these shows?
Well, I think one of the reasons you're seeing the mother character get such good, such diverse treatment is that there are now more women in the writer's room. There are more female showrunners in television. They're still way out of balance, but you look at the credits on some of these shows, and you're seeing far more women's names than you ever saw before. And so what puzzles me is why the same isn't true for fathers. It, to me, the father character on television is still pretty much stuck in one of two ruts. It's either the taciturn dad with the serious advice, or it's what I call the doofus dad, which is what the kind of father you still see in pretty much any sitcom there is. Dad is always the idiot. The kids are smarter than dad. The wife is smarter than dad. Dad is a doofus.
There seems to be plenty of that these days. Maybe that's the ascent of the mother. And then you get young mothers talking with each other, and it runs right off the TV screen. You talk about 47 Secrets to a Younger You. This is a web series. I've got a little clip here. Laura Frenzer and Rohana Kennan playing Julie and Karma, two mothers living in New York. Second episode.
Hey. How are you?
Fine, just a little antsy.
Too much coffee.
Oh, no such thing.
Hey, check out my new Amore date tonight.
How cute.
I know, right? I was trying not to get too excited, but okay, so like, also divorced, mm-hmm. has kids, oh, nice. Published author.
Okay.
Avid outdoorsman. Musician. Everyone's a musician.
Neil, these are 5 minutes long, and you've got the New York Times TV critic taking note. Do they work?
It certainly worked for me, and it impressed me because just when I thought, well, television is covering every possible mom base that there is. There are so many television mothers, and I stumble on this little web series, and I realize, well, yeah, there's a type of mother that television has really not quite found yet, and it's the what happens when hipsters have babies mother. These two women who I think are probably in their 40s living in Brooklyn, and they've got each got two kids. One's a single mother, one's a husband-wife relationship, but they're still, you know, they still want to be hipster types, but they're aging out of the hipster age bracket.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a whole different type of mother that I hadn't seen accounted for on mainstream television.
Neil, it's a great roundup. We can link to it on our website, listeners, onpointradio.org. Neil Genslinger with the New York Times. Thank you so much. Hipsters having babies, we love it. Thanks, Neil. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.